And we're holding on Lamed Ches Amud Aleph, the third line. We talked yesterday about various details of Mesora that are Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. We said the fact that certain words are pronounced one way in one context and a different way in a different context, for example, Eretz versus Oretz. We said Itur Sofrim, the fact that you have sometimes words that are in the Pasuk only for stylistic reasons, or on the contrary, where you have something that you would have expected, a certain word or a certain letter to be in the Pasuk, and it's not there. Words in the Torah that are words in Tanakh that are written but not that are read but not written, you have to supply them Baal Peh, or vice versa. So all of those things we said are Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. I forgot to mention yesterday, actually, when we were talking about those words that are read and not written, or vice versa, you know, we mentioned in that connection, Meir brought up a point about a regular Kriyuk Siv. There is the explanation, the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, in Igeres Yud Tes, that sometimes you have parts of Torah that are so high, they come from such a high level, higher than the rest of the Torah, that they come down in words that we can't understand, and those are the Siv, where the word on the face of it has no meaning. And then you need the Kri, then you need to be told a different way to pronounce it. Similarly with these kinds of words that we're talking about, where you have an entire word that's read and not, and that's read but not written in the text, or vice versa, then it would be the same kind of thing we're talking about that comes from a higher level and therefore can't even come down into letters, and we have to supply it only Baal Peh. In any case, we said all of that is Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. So actually, I didn't really mention also that yesterday in this connection, the Maharal has an explanation. Now, we said most of the examples we brought, if not all of them, were from Nevi'im and Ksuvim. How do we call those? Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. So the Maharal explains along those lines that Hashem had told Moshe there are going to be such cases where you have a word that has to be written one way and pronounced a different way, or that there's going to be a word that can't even be written at all, but it's to be pronounced, or vice versa. You should know that such things are going to exist, and each Navi in his time is going to find places in his Sefer where it's appropriate to have such things. So in that sense, it's Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai, that sort of thing should exist in the first place, but the actual instances of them were given to the various Nevi'im as they wrote their Sfarim. Anyway, continuing on this topic of details of Masorah, good morning, Ali. Continuing on this topic of details of Masorah, the third line of Lamed Ches Amud Aleph, so we said one of the things we talked about pisuk timing. We talked about the truck, which separate one pasuk from the next. We said not just pisuk timing. We said elu hapsukim. We mentioned the same sechel that you have that when they read the Torah in Ezra and Nehemiah's times, they divided the pasukim, the one from another, and they made it clear where one pasuk ends and the other one begins, because that helps you understand the sense of the words when you see where a sentence begins and where it ends. So the Gemara says that the details of that are not universal, as with other things in Torah Shabbat Pass. Sometimes there are machloikas in between them. So Omer of Acha Ba'ada, B'mar Rava, in the West, meaning in Eretz Yisrael, Paskin Lahodin Psukka L'Tlosa Psukin. They divide the following pasuk, which we have in our Chumashim as one pasuk. In Eretz Yisrael, they used to divide it into three. The pasuk says, "Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Hinei Anochi Boi Lacha Ba'aba Onan." Before Matan Torah, Hashem tells Moshe, "I will be appearing to you in a thick cloud." And the rest of the pasuk continues, "Ba'avur Yishmaha Ambedabri Imach," in order that the people should listen when I'm speaking to you. "V'gam B'chol Yaminu La'olam," and they will believe in you forever. And then the pasuk finishes, "Vayagid Moshe as Divrei Omel Hashem." Moshe told over what the people said to Hashem. So here, so we have in Orchamoshim and in Bavel, they had the Masorah, that all of that is one long pasuk. In Eretz Yisrael, they held that this is actually three separate pasukim. And Marsha in Kedushin explains, this Gemara is also in Kedushin, Marsha over there explains that in Eretz Yisrael, they figured the ba'avur, the because, it's not really explaining the previous part of the pasuk. What is the pasuk saying? Hashem is saying, "I'll appear to you in a thick cloud in order that the people should hear." It doesn't really flow. What does one have to do with the other? Therefore, they figured that has to be a separate pasuk. And the Vayagid Moshe, when it says that Moshe told over the people's words to Hashem, also you find in all the previous pasukim that when Moshe is speaking to Hashem, when Hashem is speaking to Moshe, and when Moshe is speaking to the people, those are in separate psukim, so therefore they figured this one has to be a separate pasuk as well. So there you have an example, in other words, of where in Eretz Yisrael versus in Bavel, they have different mesoras about how you divide the psukim. I was mentioning yesterday, usually in matters of Masorah, we usually follow the Bnei Eretz Yisrael, but here, this is an example where we actually follow the Bnei Bavel, and we consider that one long pasuk. Really, when you think about it, another example of that kind of thing is Tam Elyon and Tam Tachton, when we have that the psukim of Aseres Adibros are divided one way when we read them privately, like for Chitas, and in a different way when we read them publicly, where each dibra constitutes a separate pasuk. Those also come from two different mesodas like that of how to divide the pasuk. All right, the Gemara says now, so now we learned yesterday, we got into this whole discussion about matters of mesoda and everything by way of the discussion of that we said that you're generally not allowed to charge money for teaching Torah. We said when it comes to Mikra, there may be an exception because there you're charging for teaching the Torah according to the opinion that those are not Daraisa, or because just you're teaching children and they need to be watched and you're getting paid for that. So now in this connection, the Gemara says, Amar Rav Chama Bar Chanina, Loi Hashir Moshe Ela Mepsilton Shaluchas. Moshe did not become rich only from the chips of the Luchas. Namely, the Gemara is going to explain further down on the Amud that we know that Moshe was rich. Now, how did he become rich? You could think, says Maharsha, that he became rich by charging the people to teach them Torah. But we established before, you're not allowed to. So therefore, since we know that he was rich, we have to know where his riches came from. And the answer is that it came from the chips of the luchas. When he carved out the second luchas, the luchas were made out of sapphire. So the chips of sapphire that he carved off of there were worth money, and Hashem told him he can keep them. Shenema psolucha, as the pasuk says, Hashem tells him, carve for yourself, psolucha shnei luchas avarim karishonim, carve for yourself two luchas of stone like the first ones. And the word psol, lucha, means psoltan shalcha yehe, means the psolas, the waste of them, will be yours, you will be allowed to keep. Maharsha explains, in other words, usually the word lacha means bring something of your own. For example, you have by the Chatzotzeres, Hashem tells Moshe to make two silver trumpets for the Kohenim to blow, and Hashem tells him, Asay lacha, which means that Moshe himself has to supply the silver for it. But here, how is Moshe supposed to get a hold of sapphire? So therefore, we daushin that it means that the lacha means that the waste of it, the pieces that you chip off, are going to be yours. So where did he have the sapphire from? Actually, the Medrash says that Hashem told him there's a sapphire mine under your tent. So you go and dig under your tent and you'll find a block of sapphire there and you can carve it and make the second luchas out of it. And the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yosi Rav Chanina, Lo nitna Torah ela l'Moshe u'l'Zach. The Torah was originally given only to Moshe and his descendants. His descendants would be the Levim, would be Shevet Levi. Now, of course, you're going to ask, one second, wasn't Moshe supposed to give the whole Torah to the Jewish people? So, of course, the Gemara is going to ask on that, and we're going to work that out. So, the reason is, because just like we have the pasuk psalacha, which we just established means that you can keep the chips of the luchas, the same way the word ksavlacha, when Hashem tells him, write for yourself the Torah at the end of Parashas Kisisa, then it means, Map Sultan Shaloch, just like the psolus, just like the waste belongs to you, Ask Sovan Shaloch, so also the writing of the Torah belongs to you. But Moshe Nag Batovas Ayin, but Moshe acted in a generous way with the Torah, Vinosna Yisrael, and he gave it over to the Jewish people. He didn't just keep it for himself. You actually have an interesting point. Rashi mentions, and in Parshas, at the end of Parshas Kisavai, I think it is. At the end of the Torah in Parshas Mitzavim by Yelach, it describes over there how Moshe wrote the Torah and gave it to Shevet Levi. So Rashi mentions a little earlier over there that the rest of the people came and complained to Moshe. They said, "What do you mean? What are you giving it only to Shevet Levi? They shouldn't have exclusive rights over the Torah. Hashem gave it to all of us." And Moshe was very happy about that, and he says, "Hayoyim Azen Yisalam. Now I see that you're really Hashem's people. That you want the Torah. You don't just want it to be reserved for the Levi." So that kind of fits with our Gemara over here, that in fact, the original plan was that it would belong only to Shevet Levi to a certain extent, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, a certain aspect of Torah is going to belong only to Shevet Levi. But Moshe was generous and gave it to the Jewish people. And based on that, Rashi, it would come out that he did that when he saw that the Jewish people themselves, that the rest of the Shvatim, are eager and willing to accept all of the Torah, including that particular part. So the Gemara should have all of our Kosev Omer. In fact, the Pasuk expresses what Moshe accomplished with that, with the Pasuk, Tov Ayin Hu Yevorach Bemer. The one who has a good eye will be blessed. So he had a good eye, and he deserves a bracha for that. The Rosh says that the Gemara is also thinking of the second half of the Pasuk. The Pasuk continues, Ki Nosan Milachmo Ladol, because he gave of his bread to the poor. So bread is often a metaphor for Torah. And the poor means the Jewish people. We actually find that he refers to a pasuk in Shoftim that describes at a time later in the period of the Shoftim when the Jewish people were very poor. He of pastures, it means they were poor of mitzvahs, at least relative to Moshe Rabbeinu. In any case, he was generous. He gave of his bread of Torah freely to the poor Jewish people. So the Gemara says, Masiv Rav Chista. So Rav Chista says, what do you mean the Torah was given only to Moshe Rabbeinu? The Pasuk says, V'oisi tziva Hashem, v'oisahi l'lamed eschem. And Moshe tells the Jewish people, Hashem told me at that time by Matan Torah to teach you the mitzvahs, to teach you the Torah. So to begin with, Hashem told him to teach the Jewish people. The answer is no. What Moshe might mean by that is, V'oisi tziva v'ani lochem. Hashem, he might mean, we break up the pasuk into two parts. Hashem commanded me at that time. Hashem commanded me all the details of the Torah at that time, during the 40 days on Har Sinai. Now, I, on my own, l'lamed eschem, I decided on my own that I would teach you the chukim and mishpatim, but not necessarily that Hashem told him to do it in the first place. So no proof from that. What about though? Earlier, Moshe tells them, "Re'eli mati eschem chukim u'mishpatim kasher tzivani Hashem alekoi." See that I've taught you the statutes and the laws of the Torah as Hashem, my God, has commanded me. So doesn't that mean that Hashem commanded him to teach the people? The answer is no. Again, you could say oisi tziva va'ani lochem. Same thing. You could say it means he's saying Hashem commanded me these mitzvahs, and I, on my own, went and taught them to you. There's nothing in the pasuk necessarily indicating that Hashem actually told him in the first place to teach the Jewish people. Okay, what about another one? The pasuk says Hashem tells Moshe va'ata kisvo lochem es hashira hazois. Now write for yourselves this shira. Now, the word Hashira Hazois actually primarily means the Shira of Hazinu. But the Gemara is assuming, for purposes of the question, that it means not just the Shira, but the rest of the Torah as well. In fact, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Sefer Torah that from that pasuk is where we learn the mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah, because since you can't just write, the Gemara talks about in other places, you can't just write individual parashiyos of the Torah. If you're going to write the Torah, you have to write the whole thing. So if they're told to write this Shira, automatically that means writing the rest of the Torah as well. So doesn't that show that the Jewish people as a whole were given the Torah? So the answer is no, the Gemara says Ashira Lachoda. No, it could mean just the Shira alone that Hashem told Moshe to give over the Shira to the Jewish people, the Shira of Hazinu. But that doesn't necessarily mean the rest of the Torah. But as the Gemara says, Lamanti Ali Ashira Azois La'ed B'nei Israel. What do you mean though? The pasuk continues, in order that this Shira will be as a witness for me on B'nei Israel. In other words, Parshas Hazinu, the Shira of Hazinu, goes into the details. If we keep the mitzvahs, then we'll get all the brachas from Hashem. And if not, then Chas V'Shalom the other way around, and eventually the Jewish people will do tshuva, Miyad Hei Nigolin. All of that is encapsulated in Hazinu. So if you just have the Shira, how is it an Eidus? If they only have the Shira, the Shira doesn't give the details of the mitzvahs. So what is it supposed to be made on? If you keep the Torah, then you'll have brachas, and if not, then you'll have the opposite. Yeah, but how are you supposed to know what the Torah is if you haven't been told any of the mitzvahs? There is an interesting thing, actually. There's a vote from the Vilna Gaon. Now, like this, Parshas Hazinu has 613 words in it. So there's a vote from him that all of the, that we know famously that everything is hinted at in Hazinu. There's the famous story with Rabbi Avner, the Talmud of the Ramban, where he was shown how his name is hinted at in Hazinu. Amarti Yafei Mashbisa Meinish. So from a famous story where there was this Talmud of the Ramban who went off the Derech and eventually became a high-ranking bishop or something. And at one point, the uh, the Ramban asks for forces the Ramban to come to him on Yom Kippur, and he commits various averus over there. And then the Ramban asks him, why'd you go off the derech? He says, because you always taught us that everything is hinted at in Hazinu, and I couldn't believe it. So I figured if that's not true, then other things. And the Ramban tells him that actually your name is hinted at in the pasuk. Amarti af ehem ashbisa me enesh zichram. The third letter of each of those words spells out Reb Avner. And the pasuk means, Hashem says, I said that I would move them away to the sides, and I'll get them out of here, and I'll make that their memory will be forgotten from people. So in other words, he's telling Avner, this is your destiny, that you're going to end up being destroyed and forgotten because of what you did. The guy ended up doing tshuva, and the guy ended up doing tshuva, he was taken never seen again. He disappeared, and then nobody ever heard from him again. Anyway, the Rebbe talked about it once in a sicha, pointed out, actually, you see that the initials even had the resh of Reb Avner, and even though when the Ramban told him, he was very far from being a Reb, but because the Eibishter knew that he has the power to become a Baal Teshuva and Taka to deserve that title. Anyway, so there is a well-known idea that everything is hinted at and has, you know. So the Vilna Gaon says that actually each of the words of Hazinu is a remez on one of the mitzvahs, and somebody actually in the following generation after that, somebody actually wrote a sefer where he did that. He took every word of Hazinu and found how each one is a Rosh Tevis for one or another of the mitzvahs. The word Hazinu, you spell out Hey Aleph Zayin Yud Nun Vav, then you can find a Rosh Tevis that represents one of the mitzvahs. Hashemayim, the same thing. So in a certain sense, you do have the mitzvahs are encapsulated in Hazinu. But come on, the Jewish people aren't going to be able to understand that just by reading the words of Hazinu. So how would Hazinu be an Eidos for the Jewish people if they don't have the rest of the Torah? So the Gemara says, you're right. Ela pilpula ba'alma. We don't mean that the Torah as a whole wouldn't have been given to the Jewish people. We mean the pilpul of the Torah would have been given exclusively to Moshe. And Moshe did us a favor and gave it to us as well. What is the pilpul of Torah? So pilpul means the sharpness of it. So in other words, so the Rosh relates it back to, we said before that we learn it from the words Savan Shalach. In other words, because just the shapes of the letters alone teach us tremendous secrets and mysteries of Torah just from the shape of the letters alone. If it hadn't been for that, Hashem would have given Moshe the Torah and he would have given it to the Jewish people without the Ksav. So in other words, it would have all been, so one way of understanding, it would have all been Torah Shebaal Peh. There wouldn't be a Torah Shebichsav to be able to understand just from the shapes of the letters alone that you learn certain things. Different Mephoshim talk about different possibilities, what we mean exactly. It can mean that. It can mean that we wouldn't be able to know the Tzura Sa'osius. It would all be Baal Peh. It could mean that we wouldn't know where in the Psukim we learn various dinim from, that the whole thing, whenever the Gemara asks Menahani Mili, we wouldn't have had that. It can also mean exactly what it sounds like, pilpul, the fact that a person is capable of taking one din of Torah and deriving other halachas from it, as we have all over Shas, that kind of thing wouldn't have been possible. It wouldn't be possible. A person couldn't take their own chokhmah and use it to understand the Torah. We would just have exactly the things that Moshe told us, and that's it. So instead, Moshe would have been given that exclusively, and for him and his family, the Levim, and it wouldn't have been available to the rest of the Jewish people. But Moshe was a Tov Ayin and gave it to us.
So what? Because it's written that's how.
So the fact that Moshe shared with us the words of the Torah, not just Moshe could have just told us the mitzvah Baal Peh, right, for example, and that's all we would know. Instead, we have the actual letters, which, as the Rosh says, we learn secrets of Torah just from the shape of the letters. Just for example, the fact that an Aleph is shaped a certain way, the fact that a Beis is shaped a certain way, we learn Sodas HaTorah from that. That wouldn't have been available to us. And then, like I said, there are different other explanations that it means that we wouldn't have the ability to understand how the dinim are derived from the Pesukim. We wouldn't have we would only have Torah Shebaal Peh, we wouldn't have Torah Shebichsav. So we don't have to understand those psukim now. We don't have to break up those psukim or anything like that. And as far as Hazinu, we can say that yes, it is an Eidus because they were told all the mitzvahs, but they wouldn't have had this Pilpula Daraisa, that special thing which was given only to Moshe. Marsha makes a connection between this and what we said before, that Moshe was given the chips of the luchas, because in a certain sense, both of them are like the chitzonius. You have the chips of the luchas are the chitzonius, the externality of the luchas that's chipped off them to make the actual luchas. And the same way, the Popola Doraisa, I mean, it's part of Torah, of course, but it's not essential.
Can someone see?
Yes.
Oh, so yeah. Where is
just,
it?
Just put it over here.
Here any, is
any,
good?
Yeah, any place around here.
Here is
yeah.
good.
Yes, yeah. yeah. So.
How about here?
Reb Yid, we're trying to learn Torah over here, okay? Figure it out for yourself, please. Figure it out for yourself, please, and let us learn in peace, okay? I'm sorry. There's any number of seats all over the shul. So the chips of the luchos and the pilpul of the Torah are both in a way chitzonius of the Torah. They're both things that aren't necessary for the etzem of the Torah, but Moshe was given them and we're saying that he gave it to us. There's a sicha in Chelik Yud Tes also where the Rebbe talks about at the end a similar point. That what we're saying is that ultimately, how is it that a person should be able to bechlal understand the Torah and be able to take their understanding and join it with the Torah and their understanding becomes part of Torah? So that was something that was given exclusively to Moshe, just like we're saying the chips were originally given to him, and he was Tov Ayin and he gave it to us as well. The Gemara says, "Omer Rav Yechanan, Ein Hakadosh Baruch Hu Mashu Shchinasei Ela Al Giber VeOshir VeChacham VeOnav." Hashem doesn't make his Shchina rest for a Navi only on somebody who is strong and rich and wise and Onav and humble. VeCholan Mi Moshe. All of those we derive from Moshe. We see that Moshe had all of those qualities, as the Gemara is going to go on to explain. This connects with the previous Gemara. We said that Moshe was given the chips of the luchos. So therefore, that means, in other words, that he was rich, and we're saying he had all these other qualities as well. Now, why is it so important that a Navi should have these qualities? So it's interesting that actually. The Rambam explains that we don't actually necessarily mean rich in money and gibber in money and gibber in his body and gashmias or whatever. Rather, we're talking about more baruchnias. He's osher as in sameach b'chelke and gibber as kovash as yitzra and so forth. On the other hand, the Ramban disagrees with that and says that no, we are actually talking about. Obviously both, but he says one of the ideas is, in other words, people tend to look up to somebody who's rich and who's powerful and whatever. So therefore, Navi, being that he's being sent by Hashem to the Jewish people, he has to have those qualities so the people, Poshet, should look up to him.
So you could say the person who's rich and he has all these things.
I think the Chassam Sofer says something like that. The main thing is he needs to be honored. But when do you see that a person is really an honor? When he's rich and strong and so forth, and yet he's an honor, then you know that really he's an honor. So that would also fit with this. Another point is also it has to be that the Navi shouldn't have to be afraid of the people. If he depends on them for his parnasa or whatever, then he's going to be afraid to give them Hashem's messages when they're not so pleasant to hear. As in fact, we're going to talk about in a minute as far as Amos, where a false Navi of that time accused him of doing just that. So we'll see in a minute in the Gemara. So therefore, if he's rich and powerful and so forth, he doesn't depend on other people, then yeah. In that sicha, by the way, I forgot to mention actually, but whatever makes the point is that we say with the second luchos also came the whole Torah Shebaal Peh. If it had just been the first luchos, then we would only have Torah Shebichsav, and we'd have to understand everything from within that. Now, like this, with the second luchos, Hashem tells Moshe, there's also given halacha and agoda and so forth. So that ties in with what we just said, that Moshe was given the psoltan shel luchos, the leftovers of the second luchos, as well as he's given Popola Doraisa, and he generously shared the Popola Doraisa with us.
So that's still going to be problems.
And then with that, okay. Anyway. So v'cholon mi Moshe, all of them we learn from Moshe that a Navi has to have those qualities. The Rosh makes a point, by the way. He says, when we say that Hashem doesn't make a Shekhinah rest, it means b'kvius. It means on an ongoing basis, for a person to be a Navi, he has to have those qualities. Meaning, for example, we know that at the time of Kriyas Yamsuf, the Jewish people had a tremendously high level of Gilead, of course. At the time of Matan Torah, same thing. They weren't all Gibber, V'chochim, V'osher, etc. But that was as a one-time thing, so therefore fine. But on an ongoing basis, you need them to have these qualities. There's even actually an interesting explanation. I think one of them, Mafosha, my name Yaakov, says, is that the word Mi Moshe over here means from Moshe, meaning through Moshe, the Jewish people were able to receive it on a one-time basis. Anyway, So where do we see each of these things? Where do we see that Moshe had each of these qualities? Gibur dichtiv, we see that Moshe was strong because the Pasuk says, Vayifres es ha'oil al ha'mishkan. The Pasuk says he spread out the tent, meaning the curtains, the ones made out of fabric and the ones made out of goat hair and so forth. Alam Mishkan, he spread it out over the Mishkan. And we learned in a Braisa that it means that Moshe personally put it up. Doesn't mean that he delegated it to other people. And we're told that the Kroshim, which made up the framework of the Mishkan, were 10 Amos tall. Now, since we don't find any place when it describes the equipment for the Mishkan, we find all kinds of equipment that they used. For we never find anything about ladders. Therefore, we have to understand if you want to sit. Okay.
Soon.
Yeah. Okay.
I have a question.
Okay. If it's related to what we're learning, then good. Yeah. Go ahead.
It's kind of related.
Okay. Go ahead.
It says that Moshe put up the Mishkan.
Yeah.
And Rashi says that
that he put it up, that it put it up, put itself up, right?
Hashem helped.
Yes.
Yeah. Says the pasuk.
Yeah. Vayakam Esau. Yeah. Yeah.
My question is, why was it heavy? Because the Bnei Levi, Rashi says in the previous pasuk that the Bnei Levi brought, they couldn't put up the Mishkan, so they brought.
They brought all the pieces to Moshe and he put it up. You have to remember each of the Kroshim was 10 amas tall, as we're saying over here, by 1 amma wide, by 1.5 amas thick. They weighed a lot. I think Rabbi Kaplan calculates in the Living Torah, depending on what you say the size of an amma is, they may have weighed anywhere from 1,500 to 3,500 pounds a piece. So no one person is going to be able to pick up one of the Kroshim on their own.
Also, that Moshe put up the...
So let's learn the Gemara over here.
Moshe put up the beams.
Yeah.
7 days, not only.
Yeah, yeah. So each time Hashem had to help him. Yeah. Let's.
When did they?
Rabid, we have a daf to finish, so we can discuss this in more detail later if you want. But yeah. Anyway. Okay. So the pasuk says that Moshe put up the curtains on the Mishkan, and the Mishkan was 10 amas tall. Now we never find in all the description of the equipment for the Mishkan that it says anything about making ladders. So therefore, we would say, okay, we got up on a ladder and put up the curtains. But since it never mentions that they needed ladders, means that a person has to be able to stand on the ground and put the curtains over the Mishkan. Well then, so you see that Moshe was 10 amas tall. And if he was 10 amas tall, the Gemara is assuming if he was extra tall, he was also extra strong. But the Gemara says, how is that a proof? Ema de'orich v'katin. Maybe not. Maybe it means he was tall and skinny. Or tall and weak or whatever. So in fact, Maharsha says exactly that. We were just talking about the Kroshim. The Gemara did not mention the point that he put up the Kroshim, even though, as we said, the Kroshim were extremely heavy, because there Rashi brings on the Pasuk that Hashem helped them put it up. But by the Oyel, we don't find any such thing. So therefore, we have to assume they were pretty heavy, but not nearly as heavy as the Kroshim, but still, yeah. But still, how do you know that he was tall and strong? Ela min hodin kro. Rather, the answer is we can learn from the following pasuk. Dichtiv, v'espers v'shnei luchos. Moshe says, I grabbed a hold of the two luchos. V'ashlichem me'al shtei yodai. I threw them down from my two hands. V'ashabren, and I broke them. And how big were the luchos? V'tanya, we learn in a braisa. Haluchos orkan shisha v'roch ben shisha v'obyan shloisha. The luchos were each six tfachim long, six tfachim wide, and three tfachim thick. And we said before, they were made out of sapphire. They were actually quite heavy. The Midrashim that say that they weighed 40 saw, which a saw is a measure of volume, not of weight. But if it was water, for example, it would weigh about 700 pounds. So sapphire is even heavier than water per unit. So therefore, they weighed a lot. So what are we seeing? So there's a few different explanations among the Mephoshim how exactly we see from these words that he was so heavy. That he was so strong. One point is that it says the Shittim Kubetzis actually says that we usually understand that he threw down the luchos and then they broke as they landed on the ground.
He's going down the anyhow.
Right. So the Shittim Kubetzis actually brings an interesting idea that it means that Moshe is saying I broke the luchos while I was still holding them. Well, to be able to break such heavy, strong luchos with his bare hands would take tremendous koyach. So that would show that. And there's different other explanations, among them the fact that it says, well, espois, I grabbed them. Marsha explains, in other words, when you're throwing something forcefully, you don't throw it with two hands. Because you find, for example, by Makas Shrin, Rashi makes the point over there that Moshe had to put all of the soot that he's going to use to start the maka. He has to put it in one hand, because when you're throwing something, if you try to throw it with both hands, it's not going to be as strong. You throw more forcefully when you throw it with one hand, because like this, you don't have to coordinate the two hands within the same microsecond. So the same way, it would mean for Moshe to throw down the luchas so forcefully that they broke would mean that for a moment he had to hold them in one hand. So you're talking these very heavy luchas he's holding for a moment in one hand. That shows that he was very strong.
I mean, because it's grabbing, it was coming downward from the Mishmaim.
It was coming down the Mishmaim with them, right. Right, so the grabbing is the medrash that says that actually, so to speak, you have to grab them away from Hashem, there's actually an explanation also that the Zkenim saw him coming down and realized what he's about to do, and they tried to grab the luchos away from him, so he had to grab them back, kind of. But whatever the case, the point is, according to one way of understanding, is the word for espos, it means that he grabbed them, he put them in one hand in order to throw them down. And then again, the Shittim Kubetza says that it may mean that he broke them while they were still in his hands. Even. Either way, it shows that he had tremendous koyach. So therefore, so we see from that that he really was strong. Osher, how do we see that Moshe was rich? Because we said, because we said before, he got the chips of sapphire from the Luchas, and therefore he became rich. The interesting question they asked on that is that, so that happened by the Luchas Shnias. That was Hashem told him on Rosh Chodesh Elul to carve out the Luchas Shnias and go up to Har Sinai. By that time, he had already been a Navi for over a year, for over a year. So how was he an Osher until that? So
he was busy digging out the atmosphere. So he wasn't collecting
money. He wasn't collecting gold and silver from Mitzrayim, right? No, right. So of course, I mean, a Balabatish answer you could say is before that he had wealth from some other source, and now he became even wealthier. But the Imre Emes, one of the Gerer Rebbeim, gives an interesting answer based on the famous story of Rabbi Isaac Reb Yechels. There's a shul in Krakow. It still exists now. It's now the Chabad house in Krakow called Rabbi Isaac's shul. It was built in the 1600s. So there's a story in connection with it. The person who built the shul, the story goes, he used to be very poor. He kept on having a dream that he should go to a certain bridge in Prague and dig under the bridge and he'll find a treasure. So night after night, he's having this dream. Eventually, he decides he has to do something with it. He finally goes there. He's wandering. He sees there are guards guarding the bridge. He finally goes to one of the guards and tells him. And the guard tells him, you're coming all the way from Krakow to Prague because of a dream. I'm having a dream every night that under a fellow named Isaac Yechels in Krakow, under his oven in his house, there's a treasure. And I don't bother with it. So he realizes that was the treasure that he was supposed to find, that what his dream means. And he goes and finds the treasure, and eventually he built the shul with it. So it's a famous story. So Reb Simcha Bunim of Pshiska used to tell over the story to his chassidim. He tells them, you guys are coming from all over the place in order to come to a Rebbe to ask for help in Avodas Hashem. You should realize that like this Reb Isaac, really, it's really inside you to find the treasure. The Rebbe will help you discover it, but you'll find it in your own koichas. Anyway, the point is, the Imre Emes says the same thing over here. If Moshe had a sapphire mine under his tent, as we said before, that's where he got the sapphire for the luchas. That means that all along he was rich. He may not have known it yet, like Reb Isaac in the story, but he was rich all this time without knowing it. And therefore, the Gemara, that justifies the Gemara calling him Osher even before he actually discovered it.
It looks like traveled with his tent together.
I guess it traveled with his tent, yeah. If the Eibishter can arrange that his tent should have to be pitched over a place of sapphire, then yeah, Hashem can move it around with him, yeah. Fine. So we see that he was rich from that. Next. Chacham, where do we see specifically that Moshe was a Chacham? So Rav Shmuel, Dami Tarbayo, because we find that both Rav and Shmuel say, Chamishim Share Bina Nivru Ba'olam, there were 50 gates of understanding created in the world, meaning 50 ways, 50 levels of understanding of the course. V'chula Nitnu, L'Moshe Chosar Achas, all of them were given to Moshe minus one, which means the Ram says the true knowledge of Hashem was even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have. Hashem tells him, but he says, Achora, you're going to see my back. Oh, funny, so even Moshe is not able to achieve that. As the Pasuk says, you made mankind a little bit less than Hashem. So therefore, there has to be something missing that a human being is not able to achieve that only Hashem has, which is the 50th level of understanding. In fact, in Chassidus, it talks about that when Moshe passed away, then he was able to achieve that. That's why the mountain that Moshe passed away on is called Har Nivo. Nevoi is Nun Boi, meaning there were 50 in him, meaning that at that point he was taka able to achieve the 50. But up until then, not.
So he passed away.
He passed away, right.
Because of the, you know.
Yeah, but the point is, in other words, that so we see that Moshe was the ultimate chacham. So that he knew everything that's possible for a human being to know of Elikus. That means you made him a little bit less. Yeah.
And the Eberster, yeah. Like so.
Well, but in other words, the point is that so you have the Eberster has the 50th. You're missing only one out of 50, but of course that 50th is itself is an enormous thing. Yeah. Onav, and where do we know that Moshe was humble? The apostle says Moshe was the humblest person. So therefore, so you see that Moshe had all those qualities, and so we learn from that that Hashem that all other Nevi'im, as the Rosh says, permanent Nevi'im, that is ones who have Nevu'ah long term, have to have all these qualities as well.
So we looked about the Kohen God also.
The Kohen God has to have these qualities. You make him rich, exactly. Amr Rabbi Yechanan. So now Rabbi Yechanan says in this connection, Kol Nevi'im Ashirim Hayu. As a matter of fact, it did taka work out that way. All the Nevi'im were rich. We have four examples of that in Tanakh. Moshe, Shmuel, Amos, and Yonah. Moshe dichtiv, Moshe, let's first see how we know that Moshe was rich. So first the Gemara is going to try a different source. Dichtiv, Moshe says in the story of Korach, he says to Hashem, why are they harassing me? Loi chamor echad mehem nasasi. I didn't take away even one single donkey from them. So now, what does that mean? What is he saying? Iboloi agra? Does he mean I didn't take it away from them without paying them? What, la pukiman the shoko boloi agra? What does Moshe have to defend himself that I didn't illegally take something away from the Jewish people? What kind of a shvach is that for himself? Ella dafti lo ba'agra. So evidently it means that even that he wouldn't have hana from other people. He wouldn't even rent a donkey from them. So therefore, obviously it means he was rich. He had donkeys of his own and he doesn't need to rent from anybody else. But the Gemara says, why is that a proof? Maybe on the contrary, maybe he was so poor, he couldn't afford to rent a donkey. And since, as we're saying, it doesn't mean that he would take one on his own, so there's no proof from there that he was rich. He didn't rent a donkey from them because even though he would have needed one because he didn't have the money to do it. Which Maosha explains now, the Gemara could have answered that what it means is even when he was going on a mission for the Jewish people, that, for example, when he went to, Rashi mentions on the Pasuk, when he went to Mitzrayim, that he put his wife and children on a donkey and started going, he didn't afterwards ask the Jews to reimburse him for that donkey, even though he was coming in order to save them from Mitzrayim. Fine, but Maosha says an ikur chosim and a sefer. Then Moshe is leaving out something essential. He should say, loy chamor echad mehem nasasi, when it was for their benefit. So the fact that he doesn't mention that means that he wasn't taking donkeys from them at all, even what Schar was saying. So there's no proof from that. So again, now it comes from the psalacha that we said he got the chips of sapphire and became rich now. Next, Shmuel. Where do we see by Shmuel that he was rich? Dichtiv, at the end of his life, he had anointed Shaul as the king, and now he gathered all the people together to give them his final message. He passed away a year and a half after that. We have it as Aftodah, Parshas Korach, appropriately enough, because you have Shmuel is saying the same kind of thing as Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe is saying, I've led the Jewish people loyally, so why are these guys going against me? Shmuel says the same kind of thing. I've led you people loyally for all this time, 40 years. Why all of a sudden did you decide now that you need a king? So it's Aftodah, Parshas Korach. Anyway, so he says the expression, Hinini Anubi, here I am, to speak up against me, Neged Hashem v'neged Meshichai, in front of Hashem and in front of his anointed one, Shaul, and tell me, as show me lakachti, did I ever take anybody's ox? V'chamor mi lakachti, did I ever take anybody's donkey? So again, you have to ask, ibachinam, does he mean that he didn't take them without paying? La'apukiman deshoko b'chinam. What does Shmuel have to tell us that he was so honest that he wouldn't steal from somebody? That's not much of a shrach. So evidently, again, it means that he didn't have to rely on anybody. He didn't even have to rent an ox or a donkey from them. But again, the Gemara says that's not a proof. Maybe again, you could say, like we deflected with Moshe Rabbeinu. Maybe it means that he was poor and he couldn't afford to. So in fact, Maosha teaches out with both Moshe and Shmuel. What is it? Moshe is arguing like this. He's saying, look, I haven't done anything bad to them. Why are they against me? They're claiming that I'm trying to dominate the Jewish people. You see, I haven't even taken anybody from any. I haven't taken anything from anybody. But the Gemara says, no, maybe on the contrary. Maybe Moshe is saying, maybe you could argue the other way around. He's saying, I'm so poor, I can't afford to rent an ox or a donkey from them. Therefore, they're thinking, well, you know what? He's poor. It's not right that a poor person like that should be ruling over us. So therefore, we need a different source. So the same thing with Shmuel. Maybe it means that he's poor, and therefore he's saying, therefore, in a way, the Jewish people have a valid argument. We don't want a poor person to be leading us. Ela Mehoch.
He was the
Navi, but he was also the leader of the Jewish people for many years. After Eli HaKoyen was passed away, then Shmuel was the leader of the Jewish people for 13 years or so. So even though he wasn't a king, he was a shofet. He was a shofet, like all the other shofetim. There was no king then, yeah. This is afterwards. Afterwards, they asked for a king, and Shaul was appointed. But yeah. Rather we can show that Shmuel was rich from a different pasuk. Mehoch. The pasuk describes how Shmuel would travel around Eretz Yisrael to judge the people, to teach them Torah, etc. And the pasuk says, his return would be to Ramah, ki sham beisai, because there was his house. So what does that mean? If it just means that he lived in Ramah, first of all, there's no chiddush in it, then there's no reason to mention it. We know from earlier pasukim that his family lived in Ramah. Also, then the Lashon HaPasuk should be, as Marashah says, the Lashon HaPasuk should be something like, Ushuvase Levesai Haramasa. Why mention Ki Shom Besai? And also, Marashah says, when you get down to it, Shmuel didn't really live in Ramah anyway. When his family came from there. But when he was 2 years old, his mother, Hannah, brought him to the Mishkan, and he grew up in the Mishkan in Shiloh. So he really never lived in Ramah anyway. So why are we calling it Ki Shom Besai?
He got married,
fine, but even so, he basically lived in Shiloh. So why are we saying that Ramah was his house? But Amar Rava, Kol Mokum Shaholach Beis Imay, means wherever Shmuel went, he took along his house with him. In other words, he didn't rely on anybody else to help him out. He made sure he brought along with him an RV, so to speak, and then took all of his household furnishings and all his kalim and food and everything with him, so he doesn't have to rely on anybody else. So we see that he was rich; that he was able to do that. So that's what it means. So Shuvase Haramasi, he would return to Ramah, but the really Kisham Besai, just as much as in Ramah, every place in Eretz Yisrael was his house, and therefore wherever he went, that was where he brought along his household furnishings and everything with him. So we see that he was rich. And by the way, the Gemara says, Omar Rabba, Godo Mashanemba Bashmuel, Yosi Mashanemba Bamosha. As a matter of fact, what it says by Shmuel is even greater than what it says by Moshe. We said that by Moshe, he said, I didn't take even one donkey from them. And we said it meant that afilo b'schar, means I didn't even not only I didn't take a donkey from them, which is no chiddush in it, but I didn't even rent a donkey from them. Shmuel wouldn't rent something from people even if they wanted. Now, sometimes you might have, so you might have not even just renting. You might have, for example, that he says, I need a donkey, and the other person is embarrassed to not give it to him. He's the Navi, he's the leader of the Jewish people. So the other person would be embarrassed. So Shmuel wouldn't even ask in the first place. Dichtiv, as we learn in the pasuk, Vayomru. So they answered when Shmuel says, "Have I taken anything from you?" They answered, "Loi ashaktanu, you have not held back anything from us." Oshek is, for example, let's say you have a worker and you didn't pay him his wages in time. So they said you never did that. Veloi ratzei sonu, the gomer, and you didn't ratzei sonu. Now the simple meaning of ratzei sonu means you didn't crush us. Remember, Lord, the shortish is rotzatz. But Marsha says if that's what the pasuk meant, then you should have the second tzaddik. You should have ratzatz tonu or something. So therefore, the Gemara is darshining ratzay sonu meloshin rotzin, that even if we consented, you never took anything from us. Because the Ram says, you might be that really they don't really want to, but just out of embarrassment, what are you going to say? No, somebody's asking you to borrow something and you're going to say no? So therefore, he wouldn't even ask in the first place. So Shmuel really was rich. He never needed to even borrow anything from anybody else. He was not wealthier than Moshe. We're saying the point that it says about him, that the Jewish people, the point is, Marashah says, Moshe was saying about himself. He wasn't going to explain. He wasn't going to say his full Shemach. Here it's the Jewish people saying to Shmuel what he hadn't done, what he had and hadn't done. So therefore, they can say his full Shemach. So they're saying, they're expressing a point even greater than we find by Moshe Rabbeinu. By Moshe Rabbeinu, the implication would be that he might borrow something from somebody. He just wouldn't. Uh, he, he wouldn't take it away without asking, and he wouldn't rent it. He wouldn't need to rent it, with Shmuel, we find the Jewish people agreed that not only that, he had gone even beyond that. He hadn't even taken anything voluntarily. Even if he asked them, he would never have asked them in the first place. Next, Amos. We said that another one of the Nevi'im who we see a proof that he was rich was Amos. So what happened? Dichtiv. So you have like this. The Pesukim are describing over there. Amos is saying some very sharp nevuos against the Aseres HaShvatim. If you don't do tshuva, then your kingdom is going to be destroyed. Your Eglei HaZahav that you've been worshipping ever since the times of Yeravam are going to be taken captive, etc. So then the Pesuk describes over there that Amatzia, who was the guy's name, he was the priest of one of the Eglei HaZahav there in Beis El. So he goes over to Amos and he says, you know what? Nobody needs your kind of nevuos around you. You want to give nevuah probably because you're poor and you want people to give you a few dollars. So you know what? Get out of here. Go to Eretz Yehuda. They want to hear such nevuos against us over there because they don't like us anyway. So go over there and people will give you bread to eat over there. You know, don't you have no business saying nevuah over here. So the pasuk says, "Vayan Amos vayomer Amatzia." So Amos replies to this Amatzia. He says, "You're wrong. Lo navi anochi, lo ben navi anochi. I'm not a Navi, I'm not a son of a Navi, meaning I'm not the kind of Navi that you think I am, the kind who goes around saying Nevuah in order that people should give him a few dollars. Ki voiker anoichi uvoilas shikmin. He says, in fact, I'm a boiker, which is Meloshin Boker. I have herds of cattle, uvoilas shikmin, and I check up on shikmin, a shikma in English, it's called a sycamore tree, it's a type of fig. It's a type of fig tree that mostly grows, and mostly the Gemara mentions elsewhere, it mostly grows in the lowlands of Eretz Yisrael. So now, on the face of it, if you only had that pasuk, it could mean that Amos is saying that I'm poor and I have to work for a living herding cows and taking care of shikma trees. However, instead, we have the Targum that Rabbi Yosef was an expert in, which is actually the Targum Yonason on the pasuk that says, Are mori geise yana. Amos is telling the Samatzia, you should know, I own flocks and herds of animals, v'shikmin li b'shvelt of a gemer, and I own shikma trees in the valleys, in the lowlands, meaning, in other words, that Amos is saying, you're wrong. You're thinking I'm poor and I'm saying nevuah only that people should give me some bread or a few dollars or whatever. No, I'm saying nevuah because Hashem sent me to do it, but I'm independently wealthy. I don't need it except for the fact that Hashem sent me.
He didn't know that he's rich.
Apparently he didn't know that he's rich, yeah. So now we see from that pasuk that Amos was in fact rich and owned all of that property. Next, Yonah. Where's the example of Yonah that we see that he was rich? Dichtiv. You have in Sefer Yonah, in Machdu Yonah. So you have over there, he wants to run away. Hashem has told him to go to Nineveh. So he wants to run away so he shouldn't get another Nevuah to that effect. So it says he found a ship that was going to Tarshish.
Well, one second.
It says he gave the payment for the ship. He went down into the ship. Now, if it just meant that he paid his fare, first of all, there'd be no chiddush in it. There'd be no reason for the pasuk to mention it. Second of all, then, you would expect the word to be vayitin schar roi, that he gave his payment, namely to the captain. The fact that it says vayitin schar ra, he gave its payment, meaning of the ship, means the entire ship. Means he paid the fare for the entire ship. You think about it, what's going on over here? He wants to get away from Eretz Yisrael as fast as possible. So usually a ship is docked over there. They'd we'll take you as a passenger, but we have to wait until other passengers come. We want to be able to pay for that. We want to be able to pay to make the trip pay for itself. So Yonah doesn't want it. The whole point is he wants to get out of there as soon as possible. So he offers them the full fare of the ship as long as they take off right away. In fact, actually, the Medrash goes even further. The Pasuk says over there that this ship was Ba'asarshish. Now, literally, you would translate, it means it's going to Tarshish. Tarshish, nobody's really sure where it is. Yeshurim, that it's Spain. Yeshurim, that it's someplace in Turkey, whatever. It's outside of Israel. The point would be, though, the Medrash says this ship had just come back from Tarshish. Now, when a ship comes, when a ship docks, it doesn't right away start heading out again. They have to rest up, they have to repair things in the boat and whatever. So now Yonah tells them, no, I want to get going right away. I'm willing to pay the entire fare and let's just go. So we see that he was very rich. And Omer Rab Romanus, so Rab Romanus says, you want to know how much the fare of the ship was? The full fare for the ship was 4,000 gold dinar. Now, a gold dinar is 25 silver dinar. So you're talking, so you're talking over here 100,000 silver dinar. We've learned before, for example, that we learned in Ksubas that 200 dinar, 200 zuz, would usually be enough for a person to live on for a year. So here you're talking 100,000 silver dinar. So imagine how much, so we're talking about an enormous amount of money. And Yonah had that available right then and there, and he was ready to pay that to go on the ship. So we see that he was very rich.
It wasn't like 15 days where your ships are already fancy. It was a, you know,
it was a, yeah,
no motor.
No motor, of course, but still, I guess it was a big ship. And like this, usually, especially Taushish, we find in Sukkim, was a place where they did a lot of business. They did a lot of importing and exporting over there. So Mastama, if Yonah hadn't come for the ship, they would have loaded up a lot of cargo, which they would have been able to sell for a high price. Now, like this, instead, they're having to take off. So he had to pay a huge amount. Yeah. So we see from these four examples that the Nevi'im were rich. And the Gemara says, "Va'omer Rav Yechanan." Going back to we said that Moshe received the Torah from Hashem. So Va'omer Rav Yechanan, but Tchilah Hayah Moshe Lomed Torah. Originally, Moshe Rabbeinu was learning the Torah, or Meshatza, but he kept on forgetting it. Ad Shenitna Loy Matana, until the Torah was given to him by Hashem as a present. Shenema Va'yitin Al Moshe Kachalosa V'Dabrito, as the pasuk says, Hashem gave it to Moshe as he finished speaking with him. So in other words, it had to be given to him as a present. Also, So one point is because it says Vayitin. Another point is also because it says Kichalosoi, which we douse in, it's written without the vav, so it can be read Kichalosoi. It was given to him like a kala is given to a chosin, meaning that for not just for life, but the point is, in other words, like it's given to him like something that he didn't achieve on his own, b'chlal, something that's given to him like the way a kala is given to a chosin. The point being, in other words, that, you know, different Mephoshim explain, and this is what the Rebbe also brought it in Sichas, a similar idea, that how the Torah is Chochmosei Ritzonei Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's Hashem's own wisdom and Hashem's own will. How could any human brain possibly even understand the tiniest little bit of it? So even Moshe Rabbeinu therefore couldn't. He was able, especially to learn the whole Torah in 40 days anyhow, and include everything that's ever going to be taught by any later Talmud, etc. So his brain, Poshet, couldn't handle it. So Hashem had to give him Milamayla that he's going to be able to remember it. No, that's later. The master was after the second law, because here we're talking Kichaloisa. It means it was when he finished teaching him. Then he gave him the first luchas, and then Moshe came down from Har Sinai, and things developed from there. Yeah. Okay. The Mishnah says, continuing on the topic of a mudr hana. So again, you have Reuven is also to have hana from Shimon because of a neder. So now, we've been talking about various things that Shimon is allowed, nevertheless, to do for Reuven. So now, here's another one. V'zonis ishtoi v'esbonov, Shimon is allowed to support Reuven's wife or children, afapichu chai b'mizonoisan, even though Reuven is responsible for supporting them, nevertheless, this is not considered. Now, we learned Udiyu in the Perek. We had the machlokas of Chonon and the Bnei Kohenim Golim. If a man is out of town and some other person voluntarily goes and supports his wife, not as a loan or anything like that, is he entitled to reimbursement? Chonon said, it's like putting your money on the antlers of a deer. You're never going to see it again. So the husband is not responsible to reimburse him. The Bnei Kohenim Golim said he is, because he's effectively acting as a shliach of the husband. So Tosfos discusses that our Mishnah may be like the previous Mishnayos only according to Chana. So it's only considered Mavriach Arim and Chosav. It's only like chasing away a lion, meaning he's preventing that now he's not suffering a loss. He's not actually giving him something, because after all, he wouldn't have been responsible to do it in the first place, and we see he's not responsible to pay him.
The husband
is responsible to support his wife, but when he's out of town, if he didn't, then the wife can eat less. She can use her mice yodah for it. So therefore, in that sense, you can't say that this person is actually giving something to Reuven. On the other hand, Tosfos brings a second possibility, and the Ran also brings that no, we're talking even according to the Chachamim, even according to the Bnei Kohenim Golim, because essentially what he's doing is a mitzvah, and doing a mitzvah is not considered giving hanah. Yeah, mitzvah slav lahonis, you're right.
You have a big family, right, with certain kids that can help.
Right. The Rosh also discusses over here what kind of children are we talking about. The children So when the Mishnah uses the word chayev in Zeneseyan, the wife is chayev to support because he has the one in the Tanoi Ksuba, as we learned back in the Sefer Ksubas. On the other hand, the children, we also learned over there, in principle, beyond a certain age, you're not required mitzada din to support them. There's only takonas usha, which came later on, that the Chachamim made a takona that you have to support them, but that wouldn't be mentioned in the Mishnah. Yeah, sure. So there it depends on the age, below six, above six, right? So the Rosh says that here we could be talking, when we say the children over here, we mean that there's a mitzvah, not a chiyuv. So when the Mishnah uses the expression chayev b'mizenaseyan, it would have to mean his wife, and it would have to mean only his wife, there's a chiyuv too, as opposed to the children, not necessarily. There's only a chiyuv, mitzad takonas usha, and that came later. Also, the Rosh says another possibility, he brings from a bit of time, we could be talking about a case that we learned in Ksubas, where a man gets married to a woman who has a child from a previous marriage, and they make arrangements that he's going to support the daughter for X number of years. So that would be considered, that's considered a chiyuv, because he accepted it as one of the Tanoi Ksuba when he got married. So that would be another example.
That would be
a chiyuv rather than a mitzvah. Mitzvah would suggest, so that's the thing. So one way of understanding, again, that an Oran Mishnah is only according to Chanan, the Chachamim would disagree. On the other hand, the Ram says that it would be according to everybody because we're not doing it as paying for somebody who's chayiv in their mezonos. He's only getting an indirect benefit. He doesn't have to give them mezonos, but that's not considered. That's only Mavriya Chari. And we said that they went, and since the mitzvah, then that might be fine, even according to the Chachamim.
We also learned you can't force someone.
You can't force somebody to support his children beyond a certain point. After six years old, they can go work for themselves. Continues the Mishnah. V'lo yozunos behemtoi ben tmeya ben tahora. Also, now, on the other hand, though, Shimon is not allowed to feed Reuven's animal, whether it's a kosher animal or whether it's a non-kosher animal or a kosher one, because then he's giving him direct hanah, because now the animal is worth more. But Rabbi Eliezer Omer, zonas atmeya veina zonas atahora, Rabbi Eliezer says he could feed an animal that's tamei, because he's not, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, as the Mishnah is going to go on to say, he argues there's no necessarily benefit of a tmeya being worth being fatter. The ainah zonas atahora, but a tahor animal, not. Omru loy ma ben tmeya l'tahora. So the Chum asked Rabbi Eliezer, why do you think there's a difference? Omru lahu. So he answers them, shat tahora, because we think of it with a kosher animal, nafsha l'shamayim v'gufa shaloi. The nefesh of the animal goes to Hashem, meaning, in other words, when the animal dies, it's dead, but v'gufa shaloi, but the body of it belongs to him, meaning he can eat it. So therefore, the Tosfos actually explains the line a little differently. It means, when does he have hanah from a kosher animal? Even when the body and the soul are separated, then he has hanah from it because now he can eat it, as opposed to a tmeya, he can't eat. So the point is,
then you have enough from the body. It's worse. Oh, that's one more.
One second. So wait. So he argues, shat tahora naf shal shemayim begufa shaloi, the body of the animal he eats after all, after he shechts it. So therefore he's getting a direct hanah from the fact that it was fed, and now it's worth more money. Now it's fatter. Utmeya, but when it comes to a tomei animal, Rabbi Eliezer argues, naf shal begufa shemayim. Both the soul and the body go to Hashem. In other words, he can't eat it. So how is he gaining? So how is he gaining from the animal being fattened up? That's his argument. In fact, the Ran explained that even Rabbi Eliezer would allow it, that now when you talk about a non-kosher animal, a horse, let's say, you could have the basic amount of food that you need to give it to prevent it from dying, versus you could talk about the extra food that's needed in order to fatten it up. Now, Rabbi Eliezer, So Rabbi Eliezer says the basic food that needs to live alive, to stay alive, of course, he's having enough. Now the animal can pull a wagon, for example. But we're talking about what's needed in order to fatten it up. Just the opposite. Rabbi Eliezer says, why would you need a fattened horse? And then it's going to do less work. So he says that the extra food the Ran learns, it would mean that he's allowed to give it. But with a kosher animal, not, because you are gaining from the fact that your ox is fatter, because now you can shecht it and you have fatter meat to eat. Omru loy, but the Chacham answered him, that's not a valid distinction. After all, a tummy animal also, the nefesh goes to Shemayim, but the body goes to him. He can't eat it. But Shem Yutza, he could always sell it to Goyim, or he could always give it to dogs to eat. So he has a hana from the fact that there's more flesh on it, and therefore the other person wouldn't be allowed to feed it at all. So The Ran also mentions, by the way, that the Rash balloons the other way around. He says the Rash balloons learns the other way around. That would mean that you're not allowed to, that you would be allowed, according to him, Shimon would be allowed to give the animal the basic food that it needs to live. He wouldn't be allowed to give it the extra food that gives it more energy. But the Ran says, I can't understand why the Rash would say that. No, well, then it's not a matter of tzav al chaim. That's not particular than you. So fine, you give the food to somebody else and let him give it to the animal, and that way you're not being over. That way you're not being over on tzav al chaim. You're not being over on the nedri. So what the Rashba says, actually, he says that. So what would happen if nobody fed the animal? It would die. So isn't that considered hana? But he says the fact is, at any given time, there's no particular time when you could say, if you don't give the animal food right now, it's going to die. Therefore, the Rashba says the first time he gives it food, that's not an isser. He's not causing an anah at that point, because the animal would still live even without that. Later on, he gives it again. Each time, you could say, this is not a particular time when it makes the difference between the animal living and dying. Therefore, he says that's the svara why Rabbi Eliezer might say that you can give the animal the basic food, but not the extra food. But the Ram says, I don't like that explanation, and he learns the other way around. So we'll leave the Gemara for Matzah Shabbos. Best Hashem. Shkoyach, everyone.